Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, an analyst considers the deadly attack in Pakistan. Brussels authorities announce arrests following last week's bombings. An experimental robot to help unlock the mysteries of delicate marine life.
Well, I really like this little robot. This robot can operate under the intense pressure that dramatically increases as it goes deeper into the sea.
And we hear the backstory on Bob Dylan's influence on country music. It's right here on The Voice of America. The Pakistani province of Punjab, the power base of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, is observing 3 days of mourning after a suicide bomber killed or maimed hundreds of people, mostly women and children, at a park in the eastern city of Lahore. A Pakistani military spokesman said the killers must be brought to justice. A Pakistani Taliban faction known as Jamaat al-Ahur claimed responsibility for Sunday's attack that killed at least 72 people and wounded 300 others. A spokesman said the attack was aimed at Christians and more such attacks will occur. Regional analyst Alam Payind of The Ohio State University told VOA's Victor Beatty the Pakistani Taliban faction has a history of attacking security forces as well as Western targets and religious minority groups.
This Taliban group are targeting not only the Christians, they're targeting Hindus. Some of Hindus are living in Pakistan, and also they are targeting the Shiites. So this is a group that has been condemned by the Pakistani government and all Muslim majority countries.
A spokesman for one of these groups said our suicide bombers will continue these attacks, I presume, against minorities, especially Christians.
I think the majority of the people that this group has targeted were the military officers and the military school. If you remember that about 14, 15 months ago, they targeted one of the schools that were the military officers. So their fight is with the Pakistani government and the Pakistani military. And it is a revenge that because the Pakistani government is bombarding the positions of this Pakistani Taliban in northwest frontier and also sometimes even inside the Afghan territory, Afghanistan. So there is a hot war going on between the Taliban and the Pakistani government, but they are just now attacking these other minority groups as well.
Well, this is the most horrific attack against civilians in Pakistan so far this year. The United States issued a statement saying it stands with the people and government of Pakistan at this difficult hour. We'll continue to work with our partners in Pakistan and across the region to root out the scourge of terrorism. What might that mean?
The United States is sharing intelligence. And there is a networking between the United States government and the European governments and also all of these in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, and in Iraq and other countries. So they are sharing this intelligence against these groups, which are really have become dangerous groups, all of them. Well, it used to be Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda is almost, this was after the Soviet Union invasion of Afghanistan. That invasion gave some sort of rise to the Al-Qaeda and Taliban, Afghan Taliban. And then the American troops going to Iraq, this ISIS, which was the Islamic State of Iraq, and then the Syrian Sunnis got together with it evolved in from ISIS to ISIL, which is the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. So they are becoming a danger not only to outsiders, Europeans and Americans and Israel. So they are a danger against their own people.
And Alam Payind said such attacks should underscore the risks to Pakistan for providing safe haven to terrorist groups that operate in neighboring Afghanistan. Joining me with a look at what's going on the web today concerning this story is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. Well, we're seeing some tributes coming in, some real, some fake, after this attack in Lahore. Start with a fake one, a picture of the Eiffel Tower lit up in green for Pakistan. People are sharing this image across social media. It turns out it was from 2007 and wasn't actually linked to Pakistan in any way. It was lit up green for something else. But people are sharing that falsely, saying it's a tribute. However, one photo that is real that people are sharing is the Omni Hotel in Dallas, Texas. It's lit up with the Pakistan flag on the front of the hotel. So that is an actual true tribute after this attack in Lahore.
They had these
people
sort of
are sharing.
They had those sort of things going on after the Belgium attack. You remember the different buildings that were lit up around the world.
Exactly. In fact, one of the things that people are mentioning on social media is the discrepancy between the two attacks in Belgium and Lahore. After the Belgium attack, you saw many more buildings lit up. And people on social media are calling this out, saying, why aren't we seeing just as many after this attack in Pakistan, the colors, you know, the green, white for the Pakistan flag? And people are also signaling the media, saying newspaper coverage had, you know, one person I saw said, oh, well, the Brussels attack was front page. This attack in Pakistan is on page 28. Why is it such a difference? But you have people now speculating on social media that because the Brussels attack was in the West, people, it hits home for more people in the West. They said this could happen in some place that I visit or that I live. A place like Lahore is less connected to them. So that's the theory that many people are sharing on social media as to why these are getting different coverage. But it isn't stopping people from calling them out and saying that there needs to be more attention paid to this attack. Two times as many people were killed in this attack as there were in Brussels. They said that it needs to be attention devoted to it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Andrew, for stopping by always.
Thank you.
And this is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
In a number of studies, researchers have outlined the health dangers of sitting too much and its link to the onset of some chronic diseases and early death. Now, a new report in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine suggests sitting for more than 3 hours a day is to blame for 3.8% of all worldwide deaths. The study authors also found that moderate or even vigorous physical exercise might not be enough to offset the negative effects of sitting for too long. They suggest that reducing daily sitting time to less than 3 hours a day could add an average of 0.2 years to a person's life expectancy. The researchers say the link between sitting and death was highest in Western Pacific nations, followed by European, Eastern Mediterranean, American, and then Southeast Asian countries. Lately, more office workers are using workstations that allow them to alternate between sitting and standing throughout the day. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Brussels federal prosecutors say they have charged three people with involvement in a terrorist group. The arrests follow last week's bombings that killed at least 35 people. Correspondent Heather Murdoch joins us on the line from Brussels. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you.
What do we know about these arrests?
Well, there have been several arrests over the past couple of days. Among those arrested in Brussels, there's now six in custody. One, Faisal Chaffaut, has been released. This is just coming from the federal prosecutor. He was believed to be the man in the hat in that picture that I'm sure you've seen of the of two of the bombers and a third man in the airport from CCTV. Anyway, the prosecutor says they don't have, they have not been able to verify the clues that led to his arrest, so he's been let go. There's also been arrests in Italy. A man was arrested who was accused of supplying false papers to some of the bombers in both Paris and Brussels. The German police also arrested two people accused of being acquainted with the brothers Khaled and Ibrahim Bakrawi, who were blew themselves up in the Brussels attack. And also in the Netherlands, a Frenchman was arrested.
There was a confrontation in central Brussels Sunday between far right-wing and anti-immigration protesters, and mourners gathered to remember victims of the Belgium attacks. What was that all about?
Well, on Sunday in early afternoon, there were a lot of people, hundreds of people in the square outside the Stock Exchange to commemorate the deaths of the victims. There had been a march planned, but the authorities had asked the marchers to cancel the march because it would strain the police's ability to protect the city. So people just gathered in the square and were quietly mourning. And when suddenly, out of nowhere, what looked to be scores, some guessed hundreds, others guessed dozens, but definitely scores of people in black shouting anti-immigration and anti-Islamic slogans, some doing the Nazi salute, harassing people that appeared to be Muslims or minorities. They stormed into the square. And for, I think, close to an hour, they argued with people who were already there mourning. A lot of the people ran away, and it was really volatile. The police there was already a very heavy police and army presence on the streets. They moved in and immediately surrounded that protest, allowed the people for a while to shout, and then brought in water trucks, and the army and the police got into formations and pushed those people back from the square about a kilometer back into the train station from whence they had come. And along the way, these protesters, I guess, turned over trash cans and smashed things, broke bottles. There was a few fist fights, but most of it was just verbal and throwing stuff.
Meanwhile, you've been investigating anti-Islamic State Muslims who want to integrate.
Yes. I mean, it's safe to say that the vast majority of Muslims are very much against Islamic State militants and view them as terrorists, not particularly as Muslims. But what's different here is that in talking to refugees here in Brussels, they are concerned by the fact that people are connecting the attacks here in Brussels to the fact that the Muslim community, which are Belgian people of immigrant descent, is a bit isolated. And they say people in certain neighborhoods are, in fact, isolated, and this helps breed radicalization. What refugees are telling me is that they don't want to be part of a Muslim community specifically. They want to be part of the European community. So they're working to try to learn local languages faster and to try to make make friends, European friends. It's not that they're against having Muslim friends. It's that they don't want to see religion as a reason to be friends with someone because they want to be part of this community.
Well, thank you very much, Heather.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, squishy fingers squeezing deep in the sea, and Bob Dylan meeting up with Johnny Cash. An experimental robot with a gentle touch is helping scientists unlock the mysteries of delicate marine life. Known as squishy fingers, the undersea machine can gently collect samples in deep water at depths way beyond the reach of human divers. VOA's Deborah Block joins us on the line. Hi there, Deborah.
Hi, Susan.
Well, what's this all about?
Well, I really like this little robot. This robot can operate under the intense pressure that dramatically increases as it goes deeper into the sea. In fact, it's been tried out in more than 150 meters, which is very deep, to collect samples on the reefs. It has these supple grippers that kind of remind me of a moving caterpillar or the soft tentacles of a sea creature. And this device can take the fragile coral samples without breaking them or hurting the rest of the ecosystem. Another advantage is that this robot can get into these little burrows where some sea creatures live. Well, a team of researchers at the Wyss Institute of Harvard University, they've been developing two kinds of soft robotic grippers that are designed to pick up objects of different shapes and sizes. And what I thought was really interesting is the grippers were tested in a laboratory using different kinds of vegetables, believe it or not, like lettuce.
Well, what kind of information do the scientists hope to collect other than garden greens for a salad?
Yes, that's for sure. I think they're hoping for a whole lot more. Well, you know, the scientists control this robot from a boat, you know, using a joystick. So they can, and so from there, they can actually see the samples it's collecting through a live video feed connected to the device. So, of course, they're hoping to get a close-up look at the specimens. They want to measure them, collect genetic data, and perhaps find some new sea creature, Susan, we have never seen before.
I like the name, but why squishy fingers?
I think there's a good reason for that. The grippers are mostly made from memory foam, which gives them their flexibility. Now, with this memory foam, when you squeeze it a little bit, you feel some pressure, but if you keep squeezing it, the pressure doesn't change. So this means the material won't be affected by the intense underwater pressure like a lot of other materials. But there are also plans to embed sensors on the grippers so the specimens do not have to be removed from the sea. And the scientists hope to add a tactile response to the grippers so that the person that's controlling the robot can actually feel what it's touching. Wouldn't that be amazing?
It would be amazing, especially if it touches something we've never seen before.
That's right.
I've seen pictures of when they brought up some samples from very deep in the ocean, and they come through the different pressures, and by the time they get to the boat, they're just mush. And this will help them see things that they can't see up here on the surface with the different atmospheric depths.
That's right. This is absolutely amazing.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Deborah. You're always interesting.
Thank you, Susan.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Bob Dylan's influence on popular music crossed multiple genres. His impact on country music in particular is being celebrated in an exhibit at the Country Music Hall of Fame called Dylan, Cash, and the Nashville Cats. Nikki Strong of VOA Music spoke with International Edition's Sarah Williams.
Nikki, tell us about Bob Dylan's role in country music.
Okay, well, before Bob Dylan went to Nashville to record, the place was really perceived as being conservative, a southern town, definitely not on the cutting edge of music. And that all changed when Bob Dylan bucked his record label and decided to record there. It opened doors for a slew of other prominent folk rock and pop artists at the time, such as Joan Baez and Paul McCartney and Neil Young, to also visit Nashville to record. And it helped foster a cultural exchange between all of those genres. And because of the high caliber of talent and skill and musicianship of the local session musicians that were there, which were called the Nashville Cats in this exhibit, so to speak, Nashville, or Music City, as they call it now, became a highly respected destination spot to make great music. And it is also this connection that helped make Dylan a major force in the creation of the country rock genre.
What brought Dylan to Nashville?
Okay, so this is the backstory. Dylan was recording with producer Bob Johnston in New York. And Bob Johnston used to live in Nashville, and he invited Charlie McCoy to come up to visit one of Dylan's sessions. And McCoy was a well-respected multi-instrumentalist session musician in Nashville. He came up and played guitar on Dylan's song, Desolation Row. Well, Dylan was so impressed with McCoy's musicianship, so Johnston was like, hey, Bob, there's more. You know where that came from. You should go down to Nashville to record. And so Dylan did. And in February 1966, he recorded what is considered one of his greatest albums, Blonde on Blonde.
We'll talk about his relationship with Johnny Cash.
Okay, so he and Johnny Cash, the two really bonded at the 1964 Newport Folk Festival. And they met up in Nashville in February of 1969. Dylan had recorded most of Nashville's skyline at that time when he went into the studio with Cash, and then they cut several duets. One is called Girl from the North Country, and that appeared on Nashville's skyline, and Cash wrote the Grammy-winning liner notes for the album. The exhibit in particular also focuses on how the Johnny Cash show also helped usher in a new era of country music by featuring artists of various genres as well, especially those of the country folk tradition. And Bob Dylan was one of its very first guests. Others include Linda Ronstadt and Joni Mitchell and Kris Kristofferson and Merle Haggard. The list goes on and on.
So Dylan Cash and the Nashville Cats, that's the name of the exhibit. The Nashville Cats were the talented session musicians who helped bring the music of so many of these artists to life.
Exactly. So there's like 16 listening booths, and each is devoted to a Nashville Cat of the era. So it's like David Briggs, Kenny Buttrey, Fred Carter, Pig Robbins, just to name a few. Each booth provides biographical information, archival photos, audio samples of the musician's signature licks on both country and rock recordings from the late 1960s. And 70s. And there are all kinds of golden nuggets as well as part of the exhibit. Included, there's a manuscript in Dylan and Cash's handwriting for Wanted Man, a song that Dylan wrote for Cash in Nashville for Cash's 1969 album Johnny Cash at San Quentin. Paul McCartney's tape box for the master tapes and track sheets from his 1974 sessions in Nashville are there. There's a guitar and harmonica that Dylan used in the early 1960s. It's going to be a concert from the songs from the Blonde on Blonde album. album. There's guitar workshops. There's a bunch of fun stuff. And there's also a CD that you can actually purchase as part of the exhibit. You can buy it off Amazon. And the name of the CD is the same title of the exhibit. You can find out all kinds of stuff about the exhibit at countrymusichalloffame.org.
The exhibit is called Dylan Cash and the Nashville Cats. It runs until December of 2016 at the Country Music's Hall of Fame and Museum in Nashville, Tennessee. You can also hear all kinds of country music on VOA One's Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong. If you're on social media, you can reach Nikki on Facebook at VOA Music or on Twitter at VOA_music. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
The guilty undertaker sighs, the lonesome organ grinder cries, the silver saxophones say I should refuse you. The cracked bells and washed out horns blow into my face with scorn, but it's not that way, I wasn't born to lose you.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During the 31st regular session of the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, United States delegates raised concerns regarding human rights in Syria, Iran, Burundi, South Sudan, North Korea, and China. They also highlighted abuses in several other countries. The delegates congratulated the government of Burma for taking key steps in the direction of democracy, but noted concern about continued military influence over the parliament and key ministries, abuses and discrimination against ethnic and religious minorities, and continued legal restrictions on freedoms of speech, assembly, and association. The United States led a joint statement on freedom of expression and peaceful transitions within democracies. 66 countries supported the statement, welcoming actions taken by states undergoing transitions to protect freedom of expression. The United States also supported important resolutions on the need for the protection of human rights defenders and the freedom to peacefully protest. The Council defeated an unprecedented number of hostile amendments, 31, which aimed to weaken the resolution on human rights defenders. U.S. Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Theodore Allegra, highlighted abuses in Latin America. The Venezuelan government uses detentions to suppress and punish government critics, including the political opposition, civil society, and independent media, he said. We call for the release of political prisoners and justice for those tortured and mistreated in detention. He also called on Cuba to end the practice of arbitrary short-term detention, respect freedoms of expression and assembly, and release all political prisoners. Regarding Russia, Mr. Allegra said the U.S. remains concerned about the occupation of Crimea and Russia's actions in eastern Ukraine. Domestically, the Russian government increasingly restricts freedom of expression while creating a climate of impunity for harassment and attacks against activists, journalists, and the political opposition. The promotion of human rights remains a pillar of U.S. foreign policy. The fight for greater freedom, greater respect, greater dignity is a unifying narrative of our humanity in all its diversity, Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken said recently. That is why we are very proud to join this council in upholding our common responsibility to this universal pursuit. The United Nations Human Rights Council celebrated its 10th anniversary this month. The United States' commitment to the mandate and mission of the Council runs deep into our nation's history, Deputy Secretary of State Blinken said in an address to the high-level segment. It is engraved into our nation's founding values and etched into the standards we strive to hold ourselves to every day.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.